My name is Lori Collier. I represent St. Anne's, and I will be leading us off to start with, and I also would like to take a minute to introduce my co-presenters.
Hi, everybody. I'm Connie Hanlon, and I'm from First Place for Youth.
Hi. Thanks for being here, everybody. My name is Carl Calhoun. I'm with United Friends of the Children and the Pathways Transitional Housing Program.
So I'm going to start us out talking a little bit about St. Anne's. Each of the three of us are really touching on something rather different. So we'll go through and spend about 10 minutes each just giving you an overview of what our programs are like. And then we'll have some time at the end for questions and answers. So to start with, I am representing St. Anne's, and this is our facility. We are located in Los Angeles near downtown LA. We are a single site model, and we serve 54 young women, and all of the women in our program are pregnant or parenting. In the transitional housing, the Bogan Family Center is a 40-unit apartment building, and then we have another program for through a different funding source. So I'm going to focus on the Bogan Family Center. All of the young ladies that we serve are 18 to 24 years old, and we are a comprehensive 6-acre campus near Los Angeles. So we have in-home services, we have a mental health component, we have 174 child care center on our site. We offer parenting classes, we offer mommy and me classes, we have a mental health clinic on our site. We also have a high school and then also a full service medical clinic. So we're kind of a one-stop shop. It's about 19 different county contracts that are blended together to make our agency work. We are a very lean transitional housing program. So this is the org chart here for you so you can see how limited we are. I'm the senior director. I oversee the transitional housing director. I also see a group home on our site for 30 pregnant or parenting young women who are in the foster care system. And so Amber is the director of that program. And then down here you can see there's only three and a half family advocates. And they do the one-on-one case management services in the home with the client. So here I'm going to talk about what we do to exit young women out of our facility. And I think the handout... Did everyone get a handout? I can pass them out if you didn't get it. Yes, it's a home visit sheet. So basically I'm going to talk to you about how we get our young women into permanent housing. And it all starts for us with the orientation and intake into our program. We are very clearly, when a young woman comes in to interview with us, she's 18 to basically 21 years old, and we start talking about exiting before she even moves into the program. We want to know what is your goal, what is your plan, and how can we help you get there from the time we hit the intake process, because we have 2 years. And generally it takes about 6 months for a young woman to really figure it out. So we really start that program on the intake portion. So when you come in for an interview, what is your plan? And not what is your plan for 5 years, what is your plan of where do you want to be after you exit our program? And that's a maximum of 24 months in our program. So with that, we go through and then link every week your family advocate or case manager comes to your home, and that's the first goal on the home visit sheet. It's everything else feeds into that. So if you don't have a permanent housing plan, then employment or school or being a good tenant really falls underneath all of those things. So it's discussed on a weekly basis, and then you can see my little tick boxes on the home visit sheet that talk about permanent housing, affordable housing, market rate rent, roommates, where do you want to go? Because this is really about her. And we both agree on intake coming in is our goal for you is not to be homeless, and their goal is not to be homeless. And this talks a little bit about our discharges for this year. 34 young women have been discharged from our program. 23 or 66% were discharged into permanent housing, and then I broke that down. 43% were discharged into permanent affordable housing, and I can talk a little bit about that. Permanent affordable housing is basically affordable housing. You have to have what's called area median index in order to qualify into that program. And we've worked with about 10 to 15 nonprofit developers or for-profit developers to build relationships. So essentially what I did was a search on the internet, pass out the information to the case managers, and have them start calling to build those relationships. So now those places call us when they have intakes or apartments available because they know we refer them good tenants who are respect the peace and quiet of the program and pay their rent on time. So it's been a really exciting venture for us because once the Section 8 vouchers ended a couple of years ago, we didn't really have a plan in place. So it's really taken a little bit of time. 56% were discharged into permanent housing. Generally, because our young women are pregnant, they try to work it out with the father of the child. So then they go into basically what we call a roommate situation. 29% were discharged to another transitional housing program, and then I put 6 of the 10 were discharged because we had a funding issue in Los Angeles with THP Plus, which required us to exit youth. So we exited them into our other transitional housing program. So it just comes up as a minor disparity. And then 2%, one resident was discharged into a rehab for methamphetamine use, and then we re-intaked her back into the program after she left us. The key to what... The next slide. Thank you. The key to what we've been doing as an organization is really trying to be creative with what is the trend with public funding, and then how do we get onto the other side of that, and really teaching our youth about what it is that they can expect because they are now of age and public funding cuts affect them. In life skills groups, we have Monday through Thursday nights. They cycle through them. There's been a lot of discussion with them about budget cuts, jobs, looking for jobs, and then how does that affect them personally. And that's really helped them to build some critical thinking skills to think forward versus thinking, I have 6 months left in the program, what am I going to do? Because it really takes the youth a little bit of time to kind of get moving and putting her brain about how does this affect me. And that's a little bit about what we've worked with. And then at the end, I'll take any questions if you guys have any questions.
Thanks.
Okay. Hi, everybody. Again, I'm Carl Calhoun. I'm with United Friends of the Children, and I'm going to talk to you a little bit about our transitioning youth out and into hopefully stable housing. I'll tell you a little bit about the organization. We were established in 1979. Our goals are to provide good programming, of course, but I want to touch on the dedication to supporting foster youth in their becoming successful adults. We have a goal here that's all about a longevity in our relationship. We believe that the best impact in a relationship is over time. So many of the kids in foster care, what they've been lacking is a consistency. And what we try to bring to all of our programs is this consistency over time. And I'll talk about that as I go through this. Our program is divided into a college sponsorship and college readiness program. The college readiness works with youth from 7th to 12th grade to prepare them for college. And the college sponsorship programs offers a myriad of different supports, primarily financial support in the form of scholarships for kids for 5 years during college. I'm here to talk about the Pathways Transitional Housing Program, which is our THP. It's an 18 to 24 month program, including a possible extra 6 months of AIT, which I'll explain in just a moment. And then the main thing I want to discuss is our alumni program, because I think that's one of the things that's unique about what we do. Okay, so the basics about our program, we're a 60-bed facility right now. We do have two new sites coming online soon. We're going to open up a new site in Long Beach in 2011, which is 13 beds, and then another one in Whittier early 2012. So by the summer of 2012, we'll be at a core capacity of 83 beds. I'm going to skip the highlights and the goals just in the interest of time. I think I ran a little long in my presentation here, so can you go back to the next one? Oh.
One more. There you go. Goals?
Yeah, again, sorry.
That's one. This one?
Yes, there you go. Okay, so in terms of our transitioning our youth, I actually am here in front of you today in an administrative capacity. I do serve as the administrative coordinator for our THP Plus program, but I'm also the intake coordinator for the entire Pathways program. So I want to piggyback on what Lori was saying, which is that we start our transition discussion immediately. I do all of the initial intake interviews for prospective residents in our program. And I ask that question, what is your plan? If you were to be accepted to Pathways, what is your plan for moving on after you've finished? And I do it for two reasons. Number one, I want to get a sense of where the youth is in terms of their own awareness and maturity about their future. But I also want them to start to think, oh, this is something that is important. And in this program, this is what they're going to be asking of me, to start planning and thinking about my future in this way. The formal transition, Pathways is an 18-month program. The formal transitioning team is assembled in the 12th month. That transition team is made up of the property manager, the advocacy counselor, which is basically our fancy terminology for case manager, and the resident themselves. Okay. On a monthly basis, between months 12 and 18, that team will assemble and they'll discuss all things relevant to a successful transition. Primarily, the discussion centers around what their realistic income is, and what the reality of housing costs are. A lot of times at the first meeting we'll say, what's your plan? And the resident will say, well, I'm going to get a two-bedroom apartment. Me and my friend are going to get a nice two-bedroom apartment in this neighborhood. Eventually that might get pared down to, well, I'm going to get a studio. And the more realistic you get, it ends up, well, the best I might do right now is I might rent a room at someone's house. And frankly, that is a realistic, successful option. As opposed to them getting $1,000 a month, or $2,000 a month, two-bedroom that they're paying half for and they can't afford it. So that's a lot of what the reality check process is with these meetings. We also plan for what's called AIT. It's the Advanced Independence Training Program. And what that is for those residents that have been most compliant, fulfilled all their responsibilities, we offer for 6 months, we pay 50% of their rent in their first commercial apartment. It's a special service that we offer to the youth that have done a really good job in our program. Some of the other things that are covered in those monthly transition meetings are we check their credit so that they understand how to do that and discuss the relevancy of credit. We talk about their rent payment history with us and how that will be reflected in their future apartment. And we also run an expenditure sheet for about the first 6 to 8 weeks, starting in month 12. We track their expenditures, and then we analyze areas where they can become more aware of what they're doing with their money and how that will also affect them when they move into their apartment. And then finally, I want to say that obviously the main focus of these transition meetings, starting at about the 13th or 14th month, is to actually get on the ground and start looking for housing. The property manager and the advocacy counselor will accompany the resident to shop, essentially, for the right opportunity in terms of housing. So the other thing I want to discuss with you is our alumni services program. As I said at the beginning, we have a strong belief that the longevity of a relationship is what really brings the most return on your investment. So our alumni services program is afforded to all of the youth who've ever come through our program. Even if a youth comes into the program for a week and transitions out, they're still eligible for our alumni services support. What it does is it allows us two things. It allows us to continue our commitment to them, which is beyond just the practical. It's sort of fulfilling that gap, or hoping to help fill that gap of social support that they didn't get in the family home. It also is a practical way for us to track our outcomes. We can say 2, 3, 4 years out, are we still making a difference in terms of these youth sustaining their housing, or are they, you know, falling a bit off of a cliff and going back into instability? So the other thing about the alumni program is for it to work and for youth to continue to report back to us, there has to be a value for them. And I think, again, the value is the fact that the relationship is maintained. We're keeping a promise that we've made to them about being more than just housing and being a place of social support and personal support for them. We also offer activities, workshops, and events that are designed by them and for them. And we do offer emergency financial support as well. Okay, the basics about the alumni service. It's run by an alumni youth advocate. That person is a full-time employee, and they serve as the sort of the point person between the alumni and the alumni program and the services. By the way, that position has always, since I've been working for the organization, been filled by a former resident of the program. So we offer mental health support, career and development opportunities, as I mentioned, emergency financial support on a case-by-case basis. An application is made to our youth advocate, and that application is then sent to the director. The director makes the final decision on whether or not services are offered and how much. And this is a list of some of the events we have. We have weekend retreats, quarterly career dinners, and barbecues, and holiday events. I want to highlight, though, the social networking page, because this is, you know, I'm not the social networker myself, but I understand how huge it is, and it's a really great way for our alumni to stay in touch with us. Through the Facebook and MySpace pages, they provide us with some tracking information as well as personal information that allows us to maintain that connection with them. New babies that are born, marriages, those things are listed on the Facebook page, as well as changes of address and employment status, which are things that we use to track our outcomes. And whenever we have an event, we also do fill out a follow-up services form so that we can, you know, get information that may not be coming to us through the Facebook page. And then the other aspect of our transitioning is finding permanent affordable housing partnerships. We recently developed a partnership with the Casa Dominguez Permanent Supportive Housing Complex. They've set aside 7 units for our alumni, which equates to about 10 beds. We're looking to develop more of those kinds of relationships in the future, but this is the most recent one and our first one. Some of the statistics about our program: since 2002, when Pathways began, we have been in touch with 74% of our participants, and of those, 89% are in stable housing and 74% are employed. The key to what we're doing here is about flexible funding streams. An alumni program like ours is not cheap. It is going to cost money, but it is imperative on us in the nonprofit community to look for flexible, i.e. non-public, non-state and federal funding. And we're very aggressive on that piece, and that is pretty much what supports our alumni services program. Again, we have a belief that, you know, if you think about the THP plus rates right now, I think it comes out to about $25,000 to $27,000 per youth. That kind of investment should be backed up. That's what we feel. In other words, if we're going to put that kind of money in, it doesn't make sense to just cut it off immediately and then hope for the best. We feel like a little bit of support, continued support, is going to actually protect and support that investment. And again, we make a promise to the youth that we're in more than just a housing situation. It's not kind of a sterile, here's your room, and when you're done, goodbye. We want to be part of their lives, and we make that promise, and the alumni service program helps us to keep that promise. Finally, I think this is a bit of a cliche, but I want to touch on it. We try to take very seriously the people we bring into our program, people that have skill, care, and are creative. And that's pretty much what I've got for you. If you've got any questions, feel free to ask me after.
All right, hi everybody. I'm kind of low tech, so I got my single handout. So please pull that out to reference what I'm going to be talking about. So again, my name is Connie Hamlin, and I am the Alameda County Regional Program Manager for my First Place, at First Place for Youth. And essentially, our program, what's different about us is that we are very specific about working in each county. So we currently have programs in 5 different counties. We work with Alameda County Youth, San Francisco County Youth, Contra Costa County Youth, Solano County Youth, and we now have our newest program in Los Angeles. The only caveat is our San Francisco County Youth actually live in Alameda County as well because of the, you know, costs of living, ultimately. Our program, our organization started in 1998. Amy Lemley and Deanne Perrin are our co-founders. And so they created this particular program initially as a loan program for our young people. They really targeted both single and single youth as well as our parenting youth to really help them with the startup fees of getting their own place. So from the beginning, it was really about trying to help young people do things on their own. Self-sufficiency was really the sort of core value of our organization. Since then, we've built our program more up around wraparound services. So our program at this point is really about relationships. Relationships between two people. For each young person, they have a youth advocate, which is what we call our case managers as well, and an education and employment specialist. What I always tell young people when they first come into the program is that they should be seeing themselves kind of like a bicycle. They're learning how to ride a bicycle, the bicycle of life. Learning how to have their own, so with 4 main goals in mind: housing, having stable housing, being able to pursue their education, being able to have employment and income, a sustainable income eventually, and to work on their life skills in order to sustain themselves. Again, our core value is about helping them to gain self-sufficiency between the ages of 18 to 24. And so therefore, to see their youth advocate and their education and employment specialists kind of like the training wheels. And that in the 2 years that those two folks are going to be there intimately working with them to really work on those four big areas in order to help them at the end of the 2 years to have those two training wheels come off and for them to be able to ride off with confidence. What I talk to them about is that what direction they take while they're in program is up to them. How fast they go is up to them. Whether they move at all is up to them. But ultimately, that we are there not to take away the obstacles of life or the bumps in the road, so to speak, but to help them to learn through those things. So we operate in a scattered site model, meaning that we go out to the community, we find apartments at market rate rent. We also try to find apartments that are affordable housing as well, so that there's the idea that eventually, after the 2 years, they're signing a rental agreement with us, but in those 2 years, they're learning all of the skills necessary so that they can hopefully take over that lease and or go out and find an apartment similar to what we've been able to offer them and for them to be able to then get their own place and be able to sustain that. So one of the things that we do in terms of exits is that we talk about exiting from day one. And again, the piece is that we're talking to them about self-sufficiency. So the idea is that we are trying to be as real-life model as possible to incrementally increase their responsibilities and their knowledge as they go through the 2-year program. So we talk to them about budgets every month. We talk to them about their credit and checking their credit before they even enter the program. PG&E. A lot of our young people have no idea that they had a PG&E set up by somebody else. And so they'll come in with big, huge bills that they have no idea that they even have. So different things like that. We work with them on identifying their support networks. As was mentioned before, sometimes for some of our young people, at the end of the 2 years, their self-sufficiency may not be being able to get their own apartment yet. And it might be a successful exit of identifying a place that they can rent, either a room that they can rent or somebody that's supportive that will be able to allow them to stay with them. So that might mean, you know, a family member or, you know, any kind of a permanent adult support. So those are all things that we have conversations about from day one. And we are talking about that every month for the full 24 months. By the 1 year mark, we do step up the idea of, okay, now we need to start thinking about, are you going to stay in this particular apartment? Have you been doing everything you need to do in order to do that? Meaning, have you been paying? You know, you essentially have two landlords when you're at first place. You have first place and you have the actual landlord. Have you been, and I talk about the fact that it's two sides of the coin. There's program and there's the housing piece. You have to be able to pay your rent regularly every month on time in full. For us, we provide a subsidy that decreases over time so that by the end of the 2 years, they are literally paying the full market rate rent. And so, again, those are all things that we do structurally to help the young people to understand the need to be able to increase their income over time. Their education and employment specialist is working with them from day one about identifying their goals. So whether it's GED and high school diploma and achieving that, hopefully within the 2 years, or if it's going to post-secondary education and being able to maintain that. Our goal is for them to be able to at least have two full semesters of post-secondary education and be able to successfully pass that. And also with housing, again, we want to be able to help them to learn how to be good tenants. So our youth advocates are mobile. They go to their apartments to meet with the youth every week for at least an hour. The ratio for youth advocate to youth is 1 to 15. For our education and employment specialists, the caseload's a little larger. They are paired up with two youth advocates and therefore have a caseload of 30. The education and employment specialists are not mobile. Limited mobility. I mean, they do go out into the field sometimes in order to meet with young people at the schools to help them with the enrollment process, or sometimes taking them to job fairs and things like that. But for the most part, the young people understand that they need to come in to meet with the education and employment specialists in order to really plan out their goals and to work on the different things that they need to do with regard to education and employment. What else should I let you guys know? The other piece about at the 18-month mark, I should talk about, is
the point where we actually have young people do their own exit plan. They actually run out. So even though we've been talking about it, at this point it's becoming more real. Okay, in the next 6 months, you really will be exiting the program, and therefore you're not going to have the regular meetings with the education and employment specialist or the youth advocate. What is that going to look like? What are your plans around your housing? What are your plans and ability around your income? What is going on with your education? All of those things are talked about, and it's from the viewpoint of the young person. They literally fill out a form saying, these are my goals. And then we talk about realistically, how are we going to get there in the next 6 months? So that might be identifying, as was mentioned before, as well as Carl mentioned. It might be, oh, well, I'm going to have my own place. I'm going to get my own place. And that's what, from day one, that's what they're talking about. And then a year later, okay, well, maybe my credit's not quite good enough and I don't have enough income. So maybe I'll have a shared living situation. And then it becomes, okay, well, maybe that's not going to work either. So maybe I'll have to identify a room to rent or a family member that I can live with or a friend that I can live with. So different things like that, all of those things are explored and talked about, again, from day one, and then intensified at the 1 year and then at the 18-month mark. The other piece that we really operate with is we don't have alumni services that extends all the way until forever, unfortunately. However, we do have what we call our next generation services. And so the idea is to work with that young person from the time that they leave till they are 24 is our target population. We initially really work with young people at the 18, you know, once they turn 18 and when, as they're coming out of the foster care system. And so the idea of the self-sufficiency is that we're working with them from 18 until 24 to really gain that self-sufficiency. That realistically being able to have an income that's going to sustain them is something that, quite frankly, in California and in the Bay Area, it's way more than, you know, a young person. The United Way did a study on this, and in the Bay Area, a young person has to make, if they're a single young person, has to make around $25,000 a year to be able to just get by. For a parent of one child, they have to make about $35,000 a year in order to just make it. So the realistic idea of them being able to do that by the end of 2 years probably isn't going to happen. And so therefore, what we want to be able to create the foundation so that they can. And again, that's where education and employment services is the core of our next generation services. And so that is being built out right now. It's not totally together, but what our idea is that, you know, we also do not close the doors to any of our alumni and youth. They are always welcome to make contact with First Place, and in any way that we can, we will still support them. But the idea with education and employment services is to be able to offer them that ability to come back, and if they have stable housing, if they are, you know, had exited our program successfully, then what we want to do is be able to extend them the ability to keep coming to our education and employment specialist to get light to moderate touch, to be able to keep supporting them around education, keep them supporting them around employment. For those that do not exit well, if they are prematurely asked to leave for various reasons, whether it's because of lack of follow through with regard to housing piece, or lack of follow through with regard to the program piece, or sometimes both, then they are always welcome to come back. What we always try to do is talk to the young person about the idea that we do not want them to utilize their full 24 months and be in the exact same spot that they were in when they came to us. So therefore, we talk. So that's why with every month we really review, well, how are you doing? And so we're very outcomes oriented. And the way that we do that is that we do a 3-month assessment every 3 months with every young person. So the youth advocate talks to them about, okay, where are you at with your housing? Where are you at with your education? Where are you at with your employment? Where are you at with your life skills? If you're a parenting youth, how are you doing with your parenting skills? All of those things. And so really, we try to connect them with as many resources as possible while they're in our program. And the idea is to resource and refer them out to things that they can that are sustainable once they are no longer a part of First Place. What we don't want them to do is to be able to glom onto us and then not have any other supports outside of us once we're not, you know, actively in their life. The other thing that I wanted to make sure that I talked about is that for our, as a sort of basic framework that we operate in, I'm not sure if folks are familiar with the transitions framework. But it is something that we, through the Andrews Family Foundation, and it's a framework that is developed by William Bridges. The transitions framework basically talks a lot about just the difference between change and transition. We all know that we go through lots and lots of changes. We know that our youth go through lots and lots of changes. But how thoughtful are we with regard to helping them to manage transition? And that's the process through which they actually go through in order to understand, how do I integrate this change that's going to be happening, whether it's leaving foster care. These are things that they might not have any choice about. So how do I deal with this? So throughout their time in program, that's something that we also operate with, is the transition framework. So we talk about the endings to things when something changes, the neutral zone, and what does that look like, as well as new beginnings. And so we talk with them about that throughout their time in program with every change. And we help that young person to identify what is their major change that's going on in their life, and helping them to then manage that transition. And so that includes their entry into our program, and then eventually the exit out of our program into a more light touch type of relationship. Thanks.
So we've talked about three different models of transitional housing: the single site, the scattered site, and then My First Place are in both Northern and Southern California, and how they also exit youth out. So I wanted to open up to you guys for any questions that you may have. Yes?
I understand and appreciate the need to have the conversation early on about exiting from the program. I guess my concern is whether or not this is a bar to difficult to serve transition age youth who may not be able to answer that question adequately. Can you talk about how you're able to screen in difficult to serve transition age youth, and how you're able to help them exit successfully?
Sure. Do you have a particular person or model?
You all talk.
Okay. Mm-hmm. For us, we have young mothers. So for them, when you're going through the orientation and the interview process, they're really hitting four different staff members that really are having the same message that goes through the entire process. So when you call in, you go to an orientation, you meet the staff who does the orientation, who talks about our program, our expectations, and being a single site model is challenging. So we've really structured that in a very particular way to try to make sure that we've eliminated most of the dangers, so to speak, that come with our population. So because we are one big housing program. So then there's that piece. So instantly there you kind of peel off 25% who don't want to deal with how we expect our housing model to roll with. So with that, then when you come in, you hit the person who's talking about what our expectations are as the program. How do we expect young women to be in our program? You know, fighting is not something we want to work with. Drugs, we work with it, but you ask all the questions. So then you come in and you get a phone screen. So we go through a whole psychosocial assessment that talks about who are you, where are you from, and where do you want to be? And then in the in-person interview, that then is discussed a third time. So you really have to have a chance for a youth to get feedback in the second interview about how to prepare for the third interview. So when she gets into the third interview, if you need to walk her through again, we can do that. And then we have a fourth person who then interviews you to basically see, are you learning along the way? And if you are, we can work with you. So if there's any insight, we can latch on to that, reinforce it, and then really get them in. And then we expect their first 6 months, they're probably really going to struggle. So then you wrap more services around the family to get her to be able to start gaining those critical insight skills to then start making the shift. But you've got to give her more room than you would give most youth, and kind of keep her basically coming downstairs, having a formal meeting, and having the discussion to keep that motivation in sight. And as long as I think you're diligent and consistent, you'll get that youth that's really challenging to either make a shift, or she's going to say to us, you know what, I can't live here, and then we refer her to another THP that may have a different model, because maybe ours just isn't the fit for her. And I think all of us in LA, since all three of us are in Los Angeles, we all know each other's kids. Mm-hmm. And we work within our youth to say, transition, when you go to the interview, what do you want to say? What have you learned here, and then how are you going to apply it there? And so that's the key, I think, to helping those difficult youth, because sometimes our program just isn't what they need. It's another one that's scattered site that maybe isn't as structured.
For me, for us with that question, it's a great question, by the way, because we're dealing with this subject a lot right now. A lot of those statistics I presented to you are based on a much more strict intake process than we have now. We're opening up to more challenging youth right now. As a matter of fact, this morning I got a call from the job about a young lady who has very severe PTSD related to the trauma she suffered when she originally entered foster care as a child. And it was it wasn't obvious that she had some issues, but it was clear that she had some emotional developmental issues, but they blossomed once she entered the program. And I think the reason that happened is because she was stable for the first time, which allowed a lot of stuff that she'd been putting a lid on to explode in a way. Okay, so we now have a young lady who is probably not going to be ready to get her own place and live independently. She's got too much else she's dealing with. Now, what we've had to do, and I'm using her as an example of what we do with all of the more difficult cases that we're bringing into the program, is you have to alter your definition and be flexible with your definition of a successful transition. That's really what you have to do. What a successful transition will look like for her is not what it's going to look like for most of our group. She may be referred to a more appropriate program for her emotional mental health condition, or she may be transition to a caring adult, a family member, but we are already not expecting her to get an apartment on her own and work and go to school. It's just not realistic. So we've had to adjust in some respect our vision, particularly with respect to these youth, because the alternative is that what you may gain in terms of your outcomes and reporting, you're going to lose in terms of serving a kid in need. And so we've had to make some real practical decisions about that. And we also have had to change our definition of success accordingly.
So similar to that, I mean, I think that ultimately for first place, you know, our goal is, it's about planful exiting. So ultimately, it's, again, what's going to be best for that young person? Because not everybody is the same, and their needs are not always the same. So that's why for us, we really focus a lot on what are the resources that they're going to need, and how do we connect them to that resource? Ultimately, it's going to be up to the choice of the young person whether or not they do it, right? We're not going to ever, you know, strong arm them. We might strongly suggest things and really leverage their relationship. I think it's ultimately about that relationship that you have with that young person and gaining their trust so that they understand why we're asking them to do certain things, how it's going to prepare them for a better situation than what they have or what they know. I think that's the biggest piece, is really about connecting them into all of the resources that they can possibly be available to them. And then with regard to their housing situation, it is about, well, is it a stable situation? Can we at least get them into a stable situation? It might not be renting their own place. You know, I wasn't ready at 24 to, you know, necessarily get my own place. You know, but so let alone our young people and making sure that they can. So, you know, again, it's really about addressing all of those individual things that, you know, that young person particularly needs. So I hope that helps.
Yes? Primarily, perhaps Lori, but the other two as well. Since you're in a congregate situation, how have you dealt with and how have you successfully dealt with the issue of fathers and other male relationships?
We include them. If they're positive, that's great. If they're negative, we have a lot of, if you're a domestic violence perpetrator, you're not allowed on our campus. So we really take a very parental role of a young adult. We're not saying you can't see him, we're just saying he can't come on our grounds. If he is willing to go to domestic violence classes, we'll welcome him back in the community because he's making an effort to then change him and then link in those services to our young lady. We don't allow visitors upstairs. So it is your apartment, but there are limitations. So if you have a visit, you have to request a visit, have a valid California ID, you sign into the facility, and then it's only done when staff are on site. So staff are on site 7 days a week during particular windows of time. At 10 p.m., the visiting's stopped. So then we make sure that monitors that. Substance abuse and domestic violence are probably two of the most significant behaviors we deal with.
And we encourage young ladies to file charges and then really work on what their self-worth is to then get them to the place of making the decision that they deserve better. Mm-hmm. And that takes, as you know, the cycle of violence. It's about 9 times around before they finally understand that. And we really try to be like a family to them because they don't really have a lot of, I want to say normal, but it's what they're used to and what we're used to is very different. So trying to give them an opportunity to experience something different so they can understand they're worth more. And it's challenging. Yes?
For one thing, I wanted to say to the first place person, I come from Humboldt, and we actually had a kid that was here going to Orleans here, so I'm way up north. But my question is, in coming from Humboldt, it's small, we don't have a lot of, we do have some transitional housing, catering plus things going on, more so in the last 5 years, but for a lot of our kids that have been placed out of the county from one to another, they're getting involved in with the ILS programs around the places where they're placed at.
Yep.
So, like the kid that we had here that was in first place, he did great while he was here, and then as they're doing well, you know, we're going to release them from whatever, whether they're in a wardship or a tenancy or whatever. If they're doing good, and then eventually they come back home. I'm wondering if you guys do any tracking and what the transition from one area of the state to the next is in terms of how successful that transition is and how they help that.
Sure. Ultimately, I think where we're limited, and at the same time, I think where it's a good thing, is it's all about the young people's initiative. We, like I mentioned, we have follow-ups with all of our young people, both in program as well as after they leave program, every 3 months. So so we really encourage young people to stay connected to us so that we know what is going on with their situation and how we can help them with any kind of especially light or moderate touch to be able to continue their success in how they're doing. So that's how we try to track folks down and try to track how they're doing. And we'll do that ongoing until they turn 24 at least, sometimes after. So at least I think we try to follow them for at least a minimum of a year after they've exited and more. You know, obviously the numbers dwindle, as they change their phone numbers, change their addresses and whatnot. But, for the most part, we've had a pretty good track record of trying to, keep track of how things are going and how that young person is going. It's really up to the young person. But yeah, like I said, it dwindles over time, unfortunately. It's just the way that it goes. But, we do have quite a few young people that will sometimes be gone for a couple years and then come back and, and either need some services or just want to let us know how they're doing. Yeah.
Yes. I have a question since the housing. First of all, to intervene people a bit, do the clients pay rent? How is that determined? And do they get back a portion of their rent when they leave? That's the first question. Then the second question, you stated from St. Pan's that 56% of the people in permanent housing, move permanent housing, that's with either a family member, father of the child, in my own case, what I've noticed is a huge number of youths in the Bay Area, end up moving back into public shelters after teenage people's program. That's the first thing. And the second thing that I have noticed is that I wouldn't classify moving back to a family member or the father of the child as permanent placement just because initially they were removed from that family member initially. That's how they go into the system. And what I'm saying is most of the youths who do have kids, the fathers of the kids are not actually involved in life. There's a 12 to 15 years age gap, so moving into that condition might not be, to me, classified as permanent placement.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to
Well, I'll start. as far as the first question, our rent structure, well, we have two because we have both a THP program and we, THP Plus program rather, and a THP program, and we have different rent structures for the two of them. THP Plus rent structure is kind of designated in the contract. I believe it's 30% of income for the first 6 months, and then it goes up to 40 for months 7 through 12, and then 50 for the final 12 months of the program. So that's how it works, and 100% of that is returned to them when they complete the program. For our THP program, it's somewhat different. It's a graduated scale as well, but it it operates on $100 increments every 3 months that they're in the program. Starting 0 months, 1 through 3, there's no rent. 4 through 6, it's $100. 5 through 7, 200, and so on and so forth as they progress through the 18 months. And 75% of the rent is returned to them. We maintain a 25% balance of their rent, but we use that money to take new residents shopping for domestic needs and so forth when they move in. And the idea is to foster a sense of giving back to those that haven't had a chance before you. So we don't give back all of it. Yeah.
So for first place, it's interesting, but basically it's pretty rigorous in terms of our rental structure for young people. For young people that come in, they pay a 30% of the actual market rate rent when they first move in for the first 6 months. It then increases to 40% at the second 6 months. The last year of program, it's much more complicated, and it increases every 3 months after that. So again, our idea is to really increase the self-sufficiency of the young person. So it's really about trying to get them to the point where they can pay the full amount of rent by the end of the 24 months. Does that always happen? No. Do we work with them? Definitely. And so we do allow folks to adjust their rents depending on what their monthly budget is, so that we try not to actually charge more than 30% of their actual income. And then for folks, depending on the funding stream, we also have flexible funding streams, particularly in Alameda County. And so for some of those young people, if it's funding through federal funds or HUD funds, then it's strictly 30% of their income from day one. And in terms of, what was the second question again? In terms of permanent family members being their permanent placement, that's definitely not our first choice for any of our young people. And very rarely is it with their original family of origin, like their parents. It's usually some other supportive family member if they do end up moving back with a family member. So whether it's grandparents, extended family, other things, again, that's our third choice. Our first choice is for them to actually stay in the apartment that they're in. The second choice is to be able to get their own place somewhere else. And then it's the third choice to actually go back to a family member or a friend.
Statistically speaking, do you have numbers that maintain that happening when they leave the program?
The reality is that most of our young people actually move out into their own places and don't want to stay in the apartments that they're in, mostly because while we serve both parents and the singles, it's much more complicated for a single person to actually stay in that apartment because they just remain a tenant of first place until that other roommate actually transitioned out of the program as well. Because they're individually moving in depending on when they come into the program. So, you know, one roommate could have been in program 6 months before that other person moved in. So it's a little more complicated. It does happen, but not as often. Usually they move out into their own places. With our mothers, then more often they are able to maintain their apartment and stay there. So I don't have the exact statistics for you. We do, I believe, have some on our website.
We have a combination of rent structure of everything they said. There's three different types depending on funding type. So it's exactly the same. And then for us with the family members, it just depends on the youth. Most of them do not return back to their family of origin. That's why they're in transitional housing. A lot of times it's what the youth call their mother-in-law. It's the father of baby's mother that they go to live with. And so there's a lot of discussion around that, and we try to link in whoever's involved in the youth who they call family into our process to try to work with them to manage that. And we do regular conversations of when you live with people, you get in arguments. It's just a matter of how do you argue and how do you work together versus, you know, just getting mad at each other and, you know, yelling and screaming. And there's a lot of dialogue about that. About 75% of our youth, and these are numbers from this year, I gave you 2010. For 2009, 75% remained in permanent housing for 6 months, and 85% remained in permanent housing for 12 months. We track our youth 2 years post-discharge from our program. And we have an alumni program that's nowhere in comparison to what United Friends of the Children does. It's much more informal.
I just wanted to piggyback on his comment. I'm not sure if you can ask, but when we do the permanent housing goals for moving in with family or with the mother of the child, we're actually tracking if are they moving in with family and paying rent. If they're paying rent in permanent housing, it's like a really weak situation, but they're choosing to live with their family. We work with single moms, so a lot of them do want to work things out with the father of their baby and kind of have a family unit. If they're moving in with the father of the baby and they're not paying rent, we don't track that as permanent housing because they're not paying anything. So when we say permanent housing with family members or with father of the child, it's because they're paying rent and kind of like a roommate situation, but it's with family members. Because they do want to work with building that family, since we do work with single moms and stuff. So that's how we end up tracking that as permanent housing.
When does the source of income come from? From GA or for gap employment? When do they actually have the money to pay for the program?
It's for St. Anne's, it starts out with AFDC. They all have, they're usually on the county. And then the goal is we educate them about there's a clock that starts ticking, so to get off of it as fast as possible in case you need to pick that up later in life. And we really work to get the youth employed within 60 days. And we have an internship program at St. Anne's with about 32 different positions that we've created on our campus to then employ them relatively quickly. And then the goal is to get them, because we can, obviously, if you're late to work, for us, we can work that out, because a lot of them don't understand that if you're 5 minutes late, you're late, and if you do that 3 times, then you get fired. We can work with that. We can also work with the interviewing skills and teach them and job coach them on the campus versus them going out, because we found we could get youth jobs, we just couldn't keep them employed. So that the internship really was a nice band-aid to really have them get some real-world experience to then go out into jobs, and we track their hourly rate of going up. So we try to work with them to what is the area median index to get into affordable housing. Really, you would want to be at the $12 an hour mark to make you competitive into the 50% of area median income to then qualify, because there's more apartments at 50% than there are at 35%. So that's really how we push them into increasing their hourly rate.
Well, I just want to piggyback on what Lori is saying too. It's a good question, because we don't encourage GR or any government sort of support. We're a life skills focused program. We have a very, very heavy emphasis on employment and education. Obviously, we do have long periods of unemployment of some of our youth, but even then, we push very heavily for them to make looking for a job their job, and we don't let anyone starve on the site. We feed them and make sure that basic necessities are provided for, but we don't like to, have too much more than a 3 to 4, 5 month period of unemployment, and we push very heavily for that. Now, the thing though is that even with the youth that are employed, in terms of this discussion about transition, I don't have the exact numbers, but we had a staff meeting recently. They brought in the actual incomes and the hourly wages of many of our employed youth, and what we found was that you're going to have to be up around $2,000 a month minimum, I think, to be viable for a commercial rent apartment, whether it be a two-bedroom share or a one-bedroom share or a studio. And frankly, many of our youth are coming in well below that, and they're really busting their tails and doing what they're supposed to be doing. But the reality of commercial rent and the reality of entry-level salaries makes it very difficult, even when they're working, to fit this ideal transition, which is leaving us and going into a commercial rent apartment. So we're actively dealing with this reality right now. I unfortunately don't have any golden answers for you, but it's a reality that you're going to face, which is that a young person will be doing exactly what they're supposed to do, working very hard, 40, sometimes 50 hours a week, but at $8 an hour. is that really going to get them an apartment? And so alternative options have to be explored, even for the kids that are doing their best.
Yeah, I would.
And most function.
Yeah, I would totally mirror that as well. You know, the reality is that where they actually come in with income is going to be something they've established before they've come to us. So in some cases, actually, it's quite rare, interestingly, that they are on GA or general assistance. And we don't encourage them to stay on that or go on it if they aren't on it. We also have our high expectations around working towards education and employment, particularly employment. We really, you know, focus on link learning institutes such as CivicCorps, you know, for some folks that are still needing to get their GED or high school diploma and need to get work experience. Heald College, you know, while not ideal, there's still some, you know, job experience that they might be able to gain through that program. Different things like that. We also, a lot of our moms do come in with CalWORKs, and so we do appreciate and work within that. I think a lot of times it's just wherever we meet them where they're at, and depending on, so in some cases they have zero income whatsoever. And so we definitely then step in to offer some more support in that initial phase when they have zero income. And that might mean that we adjust their rent down to zero. We will offer them, you know, we also offer food assistance to everybody when they, you know, come into program every month. It might mean a little extra food assistance. Different things like that. Then our expectation is for the young person to really work hard on the education and the employment piece, knowing that if they don't have their GED or high school diploma, quite frankly, if they are able to achieve that, that will increase, that will double their chances to actually get a job.
Is that a requirement to your program to have a GED and high school diploma?
It is not a requirement. It is a requirement to work towards it.
Yes.
This question is for Connie. What's the likelihood of a successful run with first place fund for a pregnant teen who's already exhausted after their THP time?
Does it happen? Yes. It really depends on the young person. Obviously, if they've had time before, our model works best if they have the full 2 years. We want to make sure, though, that they have a minimum of 1 year, a minimum of 12 months. If they at that point, though, it'd be similar to someone that is trying to re-enter our program and they maybe didn't make it the first time around all the way through, then some of those expectations would be a little bit higher in terms of entry. And so that might look like they would have to have some type of income, and that means through employment, for at least 3 months before being able to come into program.
And would the rent expectation be a little bit different? Because it wouldn't be the same expectation as somebody who's starting.
That's correct.
It would be sort of equal to somebody's own management.
Exactly. So the expectations would be higher because they have less time.
Yes, in the back.
Thanks to all of you for what you shared. The question is, I believe, to Mr. Calhoun. In your presentation, you said it's important to hire the right person or people. Can you say a bit more about that for all of you, about what that looks like, or your processes, or how it might have affected your agency hiring policy or your funding in terms of looking for the right person and then looking at the usual requirements or whatever?
Sure. Well, to sum it up for me, it's looking, it's at the interview, looking between the lines of what's on the resume. I have to say that it's somewhat of an intangible for me. It has a lot to do with what I feel I project. You know, it comes from me. You know, I think I have to admit that. But it's a sense of what is there beyond the facts on the resume, and I'm looking for that. I can't tell you exactly what it is, but I'm looking for something that's a little bit unique and hits me in my gut about commitment beyond what's on the paper, because the reality is that it's going to be very hard to say, to explain to somebody how they're going to react when they put in, you know, 2 to 4 months of very hard work to help a kid find a job, and 3 weeks after they start the job, the kid mysteriously quits, you know? And how you recover your inspiration and your balance, and don't, you know, spew counter-transferential negativity all over this child, you know what I mean? How do you maintain a balance under those situations? There's no clear answer for what I'm looking for, but that's what I'm looking for, is something in a person that says to me in their presentation, okay, there's something there that is ready for the intangibles, you know, the gray area of this work, because that, I feel, is what attacks our commitment and wears us down the most, is not necessarily being ready for all of the gray area about this work. And I know that's not a super clear answer, but that's the best I got for you.
I can actually, we have a much more formalized structure on that at St. Anne's. We have a values-based programming that really looks at defining the values for our organization. And then when we hire in staff, we really ask them to commit to our four values, which are belonging, skill building, independence, and generosity. And we ask our staff to use a particular languaging when working with youth to be very neutral, so that way you're not asking them to, you're not telling them what to do, and you're not over-functioning for them. It's really challenging the youth to take in the responsibility and to make critical decisions that they will then have natural consequences for. So when we're interviewing a staff, we require that they have a bachelor's level in social work, psychology, or human development with at least 3 years of paid experience in the field to then have them have some insight into their transference and counter-transference. And then we really define the youth as maybe 7 different types of youth. And then we give vignette questions in the interview asking the staff, how would you want to handle this situation, knowing that you don't know our policies and procedures, just a natural reaction to what the question is. So if there's a youth in crisis who's cussing you out, and we're all good clients when you want to be a good client. And then so how would they respond to that? If you go to, you need to, you should, you better, they can't work at our organization. That's not going to fit for us. And that's how we take a pass. And then our whole training cycle for the first 2 weeks of hire really focuses on that type of treatment throughout every program we have at St. Anne's. So that's how we've really quantified it out of those four values.
Mm-hmm. Ours is also much more formal. So at First Place, we actually... At First Place, we actually have a talent initiative, which we started about 2 years ago now. So we have a director of talent. In lieu of a HR department. So we actually outsource our HR department. And so our talent initiative really is about a lot of different things. Part of that is formalizing the actual interview process. So the way that it works currently, depending on the level of the opening, so for instance, if it's a direct service staff, then it's the direct supervisor that's the initial person who reviews the resume. In addition to a resume, in lieu of a sort of before they even get a first interview, they actually get what we call a predictive index survey. And it literally takes like 5 minutes. And it's a random clicking of buttons as to how do they describe themselves and how do they, how do you know their coworkers and or supervisors describe them. And then it mysteriously and very scientifically actually creates this graph for us to review. And so there's a several of us that are then trained in HORTA how to read that. And it's basically looking at the behavior of a person. So it's similar to a personality test, but it's more behavior based. So for instance, how assertive are you? Are you somebody who is super introverted or extroverted? Are you somebody who is a very fast-paced person and works really, you know, quickly? Or are you someone that takes a lot of time and needs to process before you take that next step? Are you somebody who needs a lot of structure in your job? Or are you someone who really likes to fly by the seat of your pants? That kind of stuff. And so we actually have then a profile of each position that we match that up to. And so people who basically have a really great resume and have a profile that is similar to what we're looking for in that particular position. And the way that we came up with that particular profile is that we had folks that were doing that particular position, as well as their supervisors and a higher level director, all do that same test in order to figure out, okay, what are we looking for? Or as a person who's actually doing that job, what type of personality and or behaviors would it take to be successful in this particular position? And that's how we compiled that, and that's how we match it up to any potential candidates. After that, they then get brought into a first round interview, and during that time, that's when we incorporate the in between the lines, because obviously there's how you normally would behave, and then how do you actually behave when you're in the situation, and how have you in previous situations, and being able to talk about that. For us, in terms of the youth advocate position, our target goal is actually to have 90% of our staff be at the MSW or master's degree level. And then for those that do not, our minimum requirement is definitely a bachelor's degree in the related field and to have at least 3 to 5 years of experience.
Anything else?
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Great.